Together we will stand, fight until fall. Come on now, people, let's get on the ball and work together. Come on, let's work together.
Do it, children.
Now, now, people, say now, together we will stand. Every boy, girl, woman, and man. Oh, yeah.
Master.
Good morning, and welcome to Neighbors here on KUMD, a program here that we're bringing you to help us navigate some of the challenges of these times, inviting guests from our community to help us as we enter these uncharted waters. If the waters were uncharted before, they're even more uncharted now. Dr. Scott Latterman is a professor of history at the University of Minnesota Duluth, and he responded yesterday to an email from me in which I essentially asked him, now what are we supposed to do? Scott, thanks so much for joining us this morning, and I appreciate you being open to a ridiculously vague topic.
It's my pleasure. I'm glad to be here. Thank you.
We begin, of course, with COVID-19. We've discovered that there are a variety of issues involved in this that we hadn't thought about before. Issues of people who want to stay safe, who want to stay away from the coronavirus, who don't dare get it themselves or pass it to vulnerable people in their families. Other people who need to get back to work. Other people who perhaps don't want to go back to work but have to go back to work. People that are concerned about finances, our food systems. So many things have come together that are interconnected, and there isn't a way to think simply about these things. I've asked the question before, and I'll ask it also of you. How are you parsing this pandemic, taking it apart and looking at the individual pieces to try to make sense of how is the best way to go forward as an ethical human being?
Well, that's a complicated issue, and in thinking about this, of course, I have to recognize that I'm able to do this more from a position of privilege than many in our community and society. I have a job. That I can do from home, and that affords me a great deal more flexibility than many people in Duluth, the Twin Ports, Minnesota, the United States, and around the world have available to them. It's a challenge. Despite having that greater flexibility, it's a deeply complicated issue. And, it's an issue that I think ought to be driven by public health considerations, but as we've seen in the United States, is more and more being driven by questions of what are the implications of this pandemic for the economy, and is it time to move beyond social distancing, stay-at-home orders, and the like, and reopen things? And I think that's a bad question. I think it presents a false choice, but nevertheless, it's the one that seems to be driving and animating American politics at the moment.
Perhaps because it is animating American politics, that's why it has legs. When we set up occasionally these false equivalencies, part of the problem is that they're false. The other part of the problem is that we're not turning our attention to things that might actually help. We wonder if this emphasis on economics is healthy, and yet when we look at friends or family who have lost jobs or whose businesses are not open yet, or when they're open, they're going to have to be completely remade, we think, well, we can't not think about the economy. Is there a better equivalency that you can think of that would maybe get us moving in a more helpful direction?
Well, I do think public health considerations ought to be foremost in our minds. It seems that the choice between going to work and staying home is one that many people have to make. And it's one that, more and more, has life or death consequences, potentially. Most of us shouldn't have to make that choice. I mean, certainly we have healthcare professionals, frontline workers, people working in grocery stores, people who are providing essential services that we do need to report to work. But how we as a nation decide what to do about all the rest of us, that's something that we haven't really come to terms with, I think, in the United States in ways that we ought to. The way that our federal government has handled things has, you know, at least relative to other nations around the world, or many other nations around the world, been quite shameful, in my view. There are different ways this issue could have been handled. There could have been, for example, a decision to follow the Denmark model, where you actually have income replacement programs so that people don't face a choice between reopening a restaurant or their shop and potentially, you know, infecting themselves or others in a pandemic for which we have, you know, no immunity, vaccine, effective medications at the moment, or staying home and staying safe. And we've elected in the United States, and when I say we, I don't mean you, me, and probably most people in Minnesota, but at a federal level, at a national level, we have a government that decided that it didn't want to take that sort of responsibility for ensuring that we could handle this in a way where people didn't have to make those choices, where they could really just concentrate on what was best for them, their families, and their communities. And that means we've seen a lot of pressure then to reopen society in ways that we don't know what's going to happen yet. You know, we've got restaurants reopening this week. We've got businesses reopening this week. And we probably won't know for some time whether that's going to lead to some really awful consequences or not, with, you know, further spread of the coronavirus and people losing their lives. You know, and when I hear people saying, well, you know, I'm young, I'm healthy, like, great, you know, I'm relatively young, I'm relatively healthy as well, but it's not about me. You know, it's about us looking out for the most vulnerable members of our society, people who are older, people who have underlying health conditions, who are immunosuppressed, and, you know, is our happiness worth their lives? Those aren't decisions or choices we should have to be making, but we find ourselves having to make them because that's what our political system has decided.
I'm curious, without necessarily getting into the blame game, because that's counterproductive at this point, but if the U.S. had reacted sooner, would we have been able to make some of these decisions beforehand, or has our country just not grappled with these issues, period, and an extra few months really wouldn't have made a lot of difference?
I do think if we had dealt with it sooner, we certainly could have made better decisions, and many more lives could have been saved, of course. You know, I mean, the New York Times ran a piece on some modeling that had been done that, shown, tens of thousands of fewer people would have not lost their lives had we acted a week earlier, and many more 2 weeks earlier, you know, let alone a month earlier. We did see a failure to act, however, and that has had, you know, devastating consequences, you know, with the death toll officially now over 100,000, probably considerably higher than that. You know, this has been just an awful, awful thing. Had we acted sooner, had we had conversations, you know, it depends on the nature of those conversations. Sometimes people don't think problems are all that grave if they're not seeing evidence of people dying. You know, and I think this is one of the problems with this pandemic, is because we did ultimately socially distance, stay at home. We were able to cut down on the number of fatalities and avoid some of the worst possible outcomes of the pandemic. The fact that we haven't then seen those worst outcomes has been taken as evidence by people who are saying, see, we didn't need to do all of this. It really wasn't that bad. And that's a really awful and flawed way of looking at this situation. Was the United States ready to have a more meaningful conversation about how to respond, what it should do? I'm not so sure. I mean, just looking back historically, we haven't done a great job at having these sorts of national conversations. And we certainly haven't done a great job of having evidence drive our decision-making. And in a situation like this, in a global pandemic, evidence really needs to be what's driving those decisions. The United States isn't very well equipped to do that.
I'm curious about some of the disparities that have come to light. We've talked about a number of these on the show. We've talked about the disparity in health care access and the state of health of Black Americans, Black Minnesotans, Black Duluthians, Native people here in our state and across the country. We've talked about practical things like internet access and how tribal colleges have been struggling in many instances because their students going home on the reservations in rural areas do not have reliable internet access. Do you have any? Of course, I want to say evidence. I want to hear something positive. But do you have any hope or any thought that maybe with these things coming to light, there may be a will to try to work on dealing with some of these issues now that they're kind of in our face and hard to ignore or say, we'll get to that later.
Well, I like to think so. But the cynic in me doesn't really think so, at least when it comes to health outcomes. I think one of the reasons, in fact, we've seen such a push coming from the political right for reopening the economy, regardless of what the consequences might be, is because those who have been most affected by the pandemic are people who the right isn't particularly friendly to, people of color, low-income people, the elderly. You know, if you're a white person living out in rural Minnesota, you haven't seen the full force of this pandemic the way that people living in America's cities have. And it may seem more distant to you, and that those who are most affected by it are you know, those who you're not particularly sympathetic to anyhow. So I'm not terribly optimistic that this is going to drive, you know, a change in how we look at public health issues, providing better medical care for people. I do think that we may see more discussion about rural internet service. I know locally Pete Stauber has made this a big issue, wanting to see a better broadband across northeast and northern Minnesota. So we may see some movement there. I'm hopeful that maybe we'll see some of that positive movement in other areas, but you know, again, looking at how divided American society is, I'm not terribly hopeful. There's a reactionary base in this country that seems to be driving political decision making at the national level, that seems to have no interest in encouraging a more progressive provision of health care, better treatment for low-income people, people of color, and others. You know, that presents an enormous challenge to the rest of us to press for these things and ensure that they happen. That's going to require a lot of work on a lot of people's parts. But at the moment, no, I'm not terribly hopeful.
Do you feel that the reactionary base, as you termed it, outnumbers people who are just trying to go with a value neutral statement here, non-reactionary?
No, I think it is a minority of people, but it's a very vocal, very significant, well-organized minority. And it's a minority that has the ear of the president and the Republican Party. I mean, this is a party that's essentially been captured by that reactionary base, and, you know, is impervious to logic, to evidence, and seems indifferent to basic issues of health, security, and so on. And so while it is a minority, it's one that seems to be driving the political conversation in many ways.
So another conversation for another time would be how the non-reactionary base of people could perhaps come together and, using some of those tactics, begin to put pressure in addition with their greater numbers, perhaps?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, and that's an ongoing project. That work is happening. It's been happening for decades. But, you know, creating that sort of change is difficult because the entrenched interests desiring the status quo, you know, they're powerful, they're well-funded, and they'll do everything they can to ensure that that status quo remains. But yes, that is perhaps a conversation for another day.
Let's talk about the death of George Floyd. We have seen, in essence, this same tragedy play out, sometimes on video, right in front of our eyes, sometimes with footage. We've seen this scenario play out where a person of color going about their business, doing nothing. The jogger, the gentleman that was just killed in Georgia, out for a jog, and suddenly he's dead. Yes, there was video. It was clear video. It was up close video. It was graphic video. What about this particular incident was the final straw? And how do you think the final straw differed between people of color, their final straw, and a bunch of white folks who have thought, who seem to be feeling also, this is the last straw?
Well, I think, in this case, it was the particular egregiousness and heinousness of what happened to George Floyd. You know, the fact that you have a white cop seemingly indifferent to the pleas of people standing around on the neck of George Floyd for nearly 9 minutes, as George Floyd is repeatedly saying, "I can't breathe," and as he eventually appears to lose consciousness, I mean, it is... I think it's impossible to view a video or videos like the ones that we saw of this and not recognize that this was, you know, a crime and something that never should happen. Even those people who peddle in racism, who have appeared indifferent to the lives of people of color in this country, you know, from President Trump on down, seem to be affected by this video, recognizing that something had gone horribly wrong here. And so I think, you know, when you've got a situation like this, in which, you know, there's no question that what happened was wrong, it leads to widespread outrage. And that's the sort of outrage we've seen explode across the United States, especially among people of color, but even among white Americans who, you know, looking at this sort of video evidence, it's impossible to deny the brutality of the police in this instance and their direct culpability for the death of George Floyd.
One of the things, I've two competing thoughts trying to come out of my mouth at the same time. One of the things that has struck me, there are a lot of folks that are extraordinarily sympathetic to the police point of view. I have, of course, some of them on my Facebook feed, friends that are police officers, that have worked for law enforcement organizations, people that are married to or related to police officers. I am struck by their silence now. When I guess, as well, of course, I'm a sad person and I spend too much time on social media. When journalism makes a bad mistake, I'm horrified. I'm furious. I feel as though my job, my livelihood, my validity as a human being has suddenly been called into question. They've disgraced my profession. I'm really upset about it. Why aren't we seeing the same kind of outrage from people to whom law enforcement and the police department is so important? Why aren't they angrier?
It's an interesting question. And I actually stay off social media. I don't do social media because I find sometimes those those conversations, at least what I know of them, can be very unhealthy. So I don't know how representative that is of broader opinion, but I have been struck, actually, by the way a number of police officers and others in law enforcement around the country have expressed solidarity with those expressing outrage about what happened to George Floyd. Here in Duluth, for example, our police chief, Mike Tuscan, I thought has done a nice job in saying that, you know, what happened to George Floyd never should happen. That's not what law enforcement represents. We do see a lot of cops, of course, taking, you know, a very different perspective, either on George Floyd or in appearing to relish the idea of battling with demonstrators in the streets, many of them peaceful, nonviolent. Then, of course, you have those who are engaged in more violent activities and are facing retribution from the police. But in some ways, I've been struck, I suppose, by the vocal outrage that has been expressed by some cops over what's happened. Now, I don't know how representative that opinion is, but it's certainly something that I've noticed. And, you know, we've seen similar sorts of statements in the past, you know, in a very well-known case of police brutality, mass police brutality back in the late 1960s. This was outside the Democratic National Convention in Chicago in 1968. You know, the Chicago police engaged in widespread violence against demonstrators there. And you had a number of others who spoke out, particularly those who were people of color in the National Guard or in the armed forces who were called out to intervene in this situation, who refused to engage in violence against demonstrators in Chicago. They recognized that, you know, the police there were the problem, that it was not, in fact, the demonstrators. And so, I haven't been seeing the same things that you've been seeing, but, you know, some of what I have seen has given me hope that, and reinforced for me that not only does law enforcement provide an essential service, but that there are a number of very decent cops out there who have been horrified by what they've seen.
So that makes me wonder if there's, and again, we don't have a representative sample, this can't be scientific, but it does make me wonder if there's a difference between what law enforcement officials feel and say and are going on record and what maybe the people who love them or the people who have their back are feeling about it. You know, because I don't think I've got any active police officers right now that are people I'm engaging with on social media. And I'm just kind of wondering because it is awfully sticky. As we're wrapping up this morning, let's talk a little bit about this idea of protest. And we've learned that as white people, we have some unhelpful attitudes about protest. I asked Dr. Mary Owen, who was our guest yesterday, if Colin Kaepernick's situation, his protest, his peacefully taking a knee, is close enough to the top of our brains that we are understanding, we're able to make the connection. What are people of color supposed to do? How are they supposed to protest when no matter what they do, we're not listening to them? Let's talk a little bit about protest. I'm interested in hearing your take on are people justified in saying, I've tried everything else and you will not hear me?
I don't know that I would say, if you're asking whether it's justified for people to engage in violent protest, you know, I'm not comfortable justifying that protest, but I certainly think it's explicable. You know, when you have people who spend, you know, their lifetimes devoted to nonviolently attempting to create positive or progressive change, only to see their efforts rebuffed at every step, it becomes understandable why, in the face of ongoing injustice, like we've seen with the heinous killing of George Floyd, they lash out, they respond violently, because they've tried everything else. And I don't know that those who are engaged in that sort of violence that we're seeing are the same folks who are, you know, activists who spent much of their lives trying to create that change. We just don't know enough at this point about who it is who's engaging in this violence, who's encouraging this violence. But I certainly understand why some people might be violently lashing out. You know, for young people of color in particular, young men of color in particular, you know, watching what happened to George Floyd, who was defenseless and not doing anything that deserved that sort of treatment, you know, they look at that and they think, that could have been me, you know. I shouldn't have to deal with that. You know, why should someone like George Floyd be dealing with that? And if society isn't going to recognize my basic humanity, that I have rights, including the right to be safe, you know, why should I respect the rules of society? And so I do think it's understandable why people are violently reacting to what's happened. But of course, you know, most people aren't engaging in that sort of violence. You know, when we look at the protests that we do see across the United States, including here in Duluth, most of that opposition has been nonviolent. You know, Saturday I was at that demonstration for George Floyd, and, you know, there were over 1,000 people there, all of whom were peaceful. Were people angry? Yes. Were they sometimes shouting vulgar things? They were, but there was no violence. It was a small minority later that engaged in violence. And I think that's something that we need to remember and to recognize.
One final question on that issue. If it turns out that there is, that we are able in the aftermath of this event to find out that some of the violence was perpetrated by people who are not Minnesotans and who did come here from someplace else to advance their own agenda, to co-opt the protest, to piggyback on heightened emotion. Mary was concerned yesterday when she talked. She said, I don't want people to think that these attitudes and feelings are not held by Minnesotans, because they are. And she felt that it was important that people realize that some of these attitudes against people of color, the idea, oh, you know, we'll take a bad action and then people of color and their apologists will be blamed for it. She said, yes, these kinds of racist attitudes are held by Minnesotans. And the idea, I think, behind what she was saying was, we don't let people off the hook and we don't sit back and get comfortable and say, oh, well, that was just bad people from somewhere else that came in and did that.
I think that's absolutely right. I agree with what she said. I didn't hear the interview yesterday, but, you know, as you've characterized it, I do agree.
Dr. Scott Latterman, thank you so very much for taking some time to talk with us this morning. It has been a baffling, exhausting, wearying, painful week, at least about the time we were starting to try to get used to some kind of a normal with COVID-19. This awful, awful death of George Floyd occurred last week. Thank you for taking some time to help us try to figure out how to look at it, try to figure out how to come to peace with it, and to move on and do better. I appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Scott Latterman, our guest this morning on Neighbors here on KUMD.